5. God willing, this week we'll wrap up chapter 5 and start even on Paragvav on chapter 6. Anyone need a sheet? Okay.
Sorry,
sure.
We're
Vav? Yes, no, we're in
Parag. Okay.
Five is Hay.
So
where is Vav?
I wasn't paying attention.
Again, we are in Parakeh, but what we're talking about now is not on a particular pasuk, it's on what we saw when we read through it, because we read through the whole chapter last time, and what we saw was that the Aron is held in Ashdod. We saw that the Plishtim kept it with their idol of Dagon, which is a statue of a fish or a human being or a merman or something. And we asked the question of why Hashem punishes the Plishtim. Why is it that they suffer from a plague which we still haven't defined? We know it's a bad one, but we don't know what it is yet. Some Torim Apolim we have to find out. But the first approach was that Hashem does this in order to get the Plishtim to send back the Aron. It isn't about punishment. It's, this is the way you get them to release the Aron, if having the Aron makes them miserable. And the dominant approach among various commentators as well as Midrashim is that the goal is to demonstrate to the Plishtim as well as to the Jews Hashem's superiority over idolatry, over Avodah Zarah. It could also be punishment. Remember, we said there are two different reasons given for why they put the Aron with Dagon. Either it's respect, in which case there's no reason to punish them. They thought they were doing a good thing. They didn't understand that this is a bad thing. Maybe you want to punish them for idolatry in general. Idolatry is not good for B'nai Noach as well as Jews. If you take the view that this was to demonstrate victory, that he's claiming the Aron as a trophy, then this is also punishment in addition to education. But the education that God sends, this rebuke, now this is one I'm going to need, but I'll give you that one, comes in three different parts. There are three aspects to the education that they receive. The first is cutting off the hands and head of Dagon. Right? That's your first step. That's what happened chronologically first here. What's the message involved in cutting off the hands and head of Dagon?
No longer has human
Well, if you take the merman view, right, so now it's just a fish. Now you can have it for shalashuddas. That would be one way to look at it, along with the fact that it's a general abuse of the idol. It shows it's powerless, but I think there is
all
the element.
The thought and the action.
Yeah. Thought and action, head and hands, nice
and
idea as well.
Thought. It's intelligence.
Right. You could certainly take it that way. But I would point to source number one on your sheet, which is from Yeshaya. There's a similar passage in Tehillim that's actually said in Hallel. Parak Memvav, and I bring this parak as opposed to the Tehillim one because there are various associations between what God does here in chapter 46 of Yeshaya and what he does, what's said in Yeshaya chapter 46 and what happens here in our chapter as we're going to see. So take a look at source number one. I didn't translate it because I figured let's save the space on the sheet for the other sources. And this you can look up in your Tanakh if you want further translation. Pasuk says, L'mistadamiyuni v'sashvu v'samshiluni v'nidmeh. Hashem says, to whom will you compare me such that I will be in fact equal to them? To whom are you going to compare God and there will be a resemblance? Hazalim zahav mikis v'kesef bakane yishkolu. These people are the idolaters. So, zalim zahav, they spend gold like it's nothing. Right? Zolel is a term for squandering something. We use it also for zolel v'sove, with the ben sorer umore, someone who's a big drinker or a big eater. In general, it means somebody who isn't paying attention, is just zolim kazav, they just spend gold like it's nothing from their pocket. They weigh out, or they measure out.
Zolel.
No, it's all that is to be.
Could be. I hear it. the kesef bakonei yishkolu, and they measure out silver with the rod. Yiskirut sarif, what are they doing with the gold and silver? They hire a smith. V'yasehu el, I added in the word chol, so you'd recognize this is not a term for God, this is an idol. They hire the smith to take the silver and gold and make it into a god. Yiskidu af yishtachavu, they worship it, they bow to it. Yisau al kateif, they carry it on their shoulders. Yisbeluhu, they carry it as a burden. They put it down, it has a place to stand. Lo yamish, and it isn't going to move. Af yitzake love, even if somebody shouts to it, help me, help me, it ain't going to move. Yitzake love, velo yane, you call to it, it ain't going to answer. Mitzara solo yoshienu, it won't save the person from his trouble. In other words, it's the helplessness of the idol that Yeshaya is mocking. And that really is the theme in general in the 46th chapter of Yeshaya, is mockery of the idols. And what he's saying is there's a powerlessness to it that's being highlighted. God cuts off the head and cuts off the hands and says, see that? That's what you have with your idol. So I think that's part one of the lesson. But part two is the much more graphic element here, which is the humiliation of the Plishtim, of the Philistines. We said in chapter 5, Pasuk Vav, sentence 6, Vatichbad Yad Hashem El HaAshdodim Vayishimim. God's hand was heavy on the Ashdodim, and Vayishimim, to be Shamim, is to be destroyed. Vayach osam, and he struck them, and then the next word is written as ba'apolim, but pronounced batichorim, and that's okay, because we don't know what either one means yet. Es Ashdod ve'es givuleha, Ashdod, and the surrounding area. So what are apolim and tichorim? So take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 2. This comes from the Tochacha. The Tochacha is a warning of grave punishment and disaster that will befall the Jews if they abandon their covenant with God. It comes up twice in the Torah. The first one is at the end of Sefer Vayikra, Parshas Bechukosai, and that is relatively brief and has a happy ending of the Jews coming back to God, coming back to Torah. Whereas the second one, the one that this is from, in Devarim, it's in the Parsha of Kitavo, that one is much harsher. It is much longer. And it doesn't really have the happy ending. Instead, it sort of just ends. As the pasuk says, you will be sold there for slaves, and no one will want to buy you. And here's the covenant that God made with the Jews. Have a nice day. It sort of reads into Parshas Nitzavim, which follows up on it, where he says, okay, but you're still standing today. But it's really a very difficult read. But take a look at source number 2, which comes from that warning. Yakecha Hashem, Hashem will strike you if you fail to fulfill a covenant. Bishchin Mitzrayim, with boils like he put on Egypt. And then the word is written uva'apolim, just like here, but it is read uva'tichorim, as well as garav and charas, which refer to some kind of skin conditions, asher lo suchal lehe rafe, which cannot be healed. Okay, so now I know not what they mean, but that this isn't their first appearance. They also appear in the Chumash and with the same rewrite. So we're going to look to our Midrashim to try to explain what these are.
Who rewrites it? I'm sorry.
Right, so this is what's called the text that we have is what's called the Masoretic text. It's a text that's been passed down generation to generation. The oldest printed editions of Tanakh that we have printed, I don't mean printing press, and the oldest written editions that we have of Tanakh, there is a way that it is written, but we have had a tradition that one who reads it doesn't read it the way that it is written in the text. In the same way, on a more functional level, as opposed to this, which clearly is carrying a message. But if you remember the story of Eliezer and Rivka, when Rivka goes to the well, the pasuk says that the Nun Ayin Reish came to the well. How do you read the word Nun Ayin Reish?
Nar. Nar.
Well, that's the thing. The word, I would have read it as Nar, right? Youth, servant, young man, with something along those lines, but definitely a masculine word. However, the tradition is that you read it na'ara, and the same thing is true throughout the Torah. Meaning, there are you every word. Hang on. Every single word in the Chumash, every single word in Tanakh requires a tradition for how to read it. Some of them are more obvious, but keep in mind, there were no vowels. The idea of having written vowels, somewhere around the 9th century, 10th century, I believe, is when we start having written vowels. Until then, the reader just knows how to pronounce it because this is the way the reader's teacher pronounced it, whose teacher pronounced it, and so on down the line. So the Gemara talks about something called Yesh Eim LeMikra versus Yesh Eim LeMesoret. And what that means is that there are times when we learn lessons based on the way the word is written in the text, Mikra, and sometimes you learn based on the way that the word is pronounced, which is our Masoret, our tradition. So it talks about the example, for example, the word for, when the Torah commands us to build a sukkah, to live in a sukkah, it says, Basukot teshvu shivat yamim. I know to say the word Basukot, because that's the way I learned it's written, is Basukot. And I'm helped by Chumashim that have dots. However, at one point, the word Basukot is written, Bet Samach Kaf Taf. No oohs and no ohs. Bet Samach Kaf Taf. You could look at that word and say Basukat in the Sukkah of. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but maybe that. But that's the problem. The problem is that sometimes words are like that. And then you have to figure out, so what does that mean? If there's no of what, then what is this? But my point that I'm trying to make, and before all of the hands and all of the questions and challenges, you have to recognize is that you're always operating on the basis of a tradition in terms of how to pronounce things, in terms of how to break up sentences. Literally, in terms of how to break up sentences. There are sentences in the Chumash where the Gemara calls them psukim she'elam hachreya, where you don't even know how to read the pasuk. For example, one of the classic examples. Hashem says to Moshe at the end of his life, Hinecha shochevi mavotecha v'kam ha'am hazev v'zana acharei Elohei nechar ha'aretz. One way to read that sentence is, Hinecha shochevi mavotecha, Moshe, you're going to lie with your ancestors, he's going to die, right? V'kam ha'am hazev v'zana, and this nation is going to rise up and stray and so on. But there's another way to read it that the Gemara notes, Hinecha shochevi mavotecha v'kam. You are going to lie with your ancestors to pass away, and then you will rise again, reference to Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. There are various psukim that are like that, five psukim that are like that, where you can actually read it both ways, and it will give you different ideas. So, again, you need a tradition to know, because if you look in a Sefer Torah, I'm not going to address that specific one, because, yes, we can discuss how you would read it if you read it the other way, what happens to the rest of the sentence. I get it, Dan. That was what you were about to ask. But the point is this. You don't even have pasuk breaks in the Chumash, in a Sefer Torah. Everything is tradition-based. So what happens here is the tradition, as far back as we know, because there is no first source that says, you know, I think we should do this. You won't find it. It was simply, in the days of the Gemara, they already were saying, we don't read this apolim. We read this techorim.
So who wrote it? You're saying the Anshei Knesset HaGdola wrote it when they wrote it?
Wrote
the new
what?
Word? Like,
no, it's not written into the text. If you open up a scroll of Shmuel, you will not find the word
techorim.
Correct. You will only see apolim.
Okay. One that I find very interesting is, Du'uk Yashem Bu'olakim V'asanu V'lo Anachnu.
Right.
It's low and low.
Low as above and low as an olive.
And pronounce it low. Well,
right. Well, that's another question, is how did they pronounce, them differently? Nanette?
It's actually very typical of the study of the English literature. Margaret Fry talks about that, so that when you're looking at a particular word, you have to be learned in a certain way, so that when you look at the particular language, the writer assumes that you're going to know the biblical reference.
Right.
And so the words can mean very different things. So there's an assumption, I think, that when we, I'm not learning, but when you read a certain language, you would get both meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And so they assume that traditionally you'll know that.
Right. Well, that's even true, even without a write it this way, you know, pronounce it that way type of a thing. Meaning, that's true every time you see words here, you know, in any given sentence. I'm just adding, you know, and amplifying that there are words that have multiple messages and multiple meanings. You know, I remember vividly when I studied English literature, the professor said, yeah, you can read this poem and death actually means this, or the door is red means that. And, like, really? But, you know, that's the idea, is that there really are multiple layers, and then the question has to be, so what are we doing here? What's the substitution about? What is it that we're supposed to gain? Frankly, it's not going to be as dramatic as everybody is, you know, going to be expecting at this point. It's much more simple. But that's what's going on. Ethi?
I was going to say, whoever wrote,
yeah,
he could have, like with the Nara and Nara, he forgot the hey. Or he made a mistake on. But here we're talking about different letters altogether of those two words.
Precisely. Precisely. Eti makes an important point. First, in terms of who wrote, Chumash is God. God doesn't forget letters, generally speaking. We're pretty good with that.
Somebody decide what God said.
Right. So that's a very... Well, now you made two points, both of which are important. But the idea here is that the same way that you look at Nun Ayin Resh and read it Nun Ayin Resh Hey, that's the way one is supposed to approach this. In other words, it's not in either case, it's not a matter of a mistake. There was something that was meant to be taught there by writing Nun Ayin Resh instead of Nun Ayin Resh Hey. It wasn't a mistake that just the Hey was left off. And so too here, it's not a mistake. It's actually written this way for a reason. But to go to the second point, what you added at the end, remind me of the words you used, because it triggered something for me, and now I'm coming back. Right. So that's one of the things that I always found to be funny about biblical criticism, meaning that you find the idea among the secular Bible scholars that, well, maybe the answer is there was a mistake. And then the mistake was just copied over in book after. Well, not in this case, because Apolim Tchorim is clearly not a mistake. It's not just, one letter's missing, one letter's added, but it's an entire change of the word. The major weakness in that argument is the following. You have a community that has more than one text. It's not as though there was one book and thousands and thousands and thousands, if not millions of people were reading it. You had all these people. Did they all make the same mistake?
No, they copied the book.
They copied all from one?
I think so.
That's a very hard thing to claim. I find that to be problematic. They still have more than one copy of the book.
There weren't printing presses that would produce exact same copies.
Right.
So people had to
But can't you assume that some had it and some didn't? Like, how do you know?
And we have cases like that. But they tend to come up on smaller scale and not as something that becomes broad throughout the Jewish world. Classic example, I think I mentioned it in the Shir at some point. There's a Rashi in Parshas Truma in which the Pasuk says, talking about what to put into the Mishkan that they're building, Eis kol asher atzaveh os kol b'nei Yisrael, all that I'm going to command you for the Jews. And Rashi says, don't be bothered by the vav. Don't worry about it. It doesn't change the meaning. It's like these vavs in these other cases. And you look at your Chumash and there's no vav. There's no vav. And the commentators of Rashi's day already knew that. But Rashi apparently had access to a Torah which had the Vav. And so he thought that was the right thing. But you don't find that the entire world gets it. In his community, they had it. Here and there in Europe, there may have been communities that copied from that, that had a sofer who made a mistake, and that was the way he did it. But it doesn't become national practice. Elena.
Now, it's been talked about in Yeshayahu, the Edomim Aramim example. The thing that bothers me about that is that we like the explanation of both. Is that the same kind of thing?
In that case, both words have meaning and
that's
both
what I'm
fit.
Saying. These both don't have meaning.
Well, that's what we have to find out.
Okay.
That's precisely what we need to find out.
According to what you're saying, is it not a synonym? No, is it not a rule that we always have to learn something from the Kri and we always have to learn something from the Ksi? Is that what you're saying?
The reason I'm hedging and the reason I'm not 100% on it is because of the classic Kri and Ktiv of Hey Vav Aleph, which is sometimes who and is sometimes he, mm-hmm. right? Which in English will be, of course, sometimes he, sometimes she, mm-hmm. And confusing all the non-Hebrew speakers. But there, I don't recall a specific lesson from that as much as that back in the day, you used the same written pronoun to refer to both. And, don't get hung up on it kind of a thing. So that's why I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
All right. So going back here, what is this Torim Apolim? What is this about? So take a look at the Sifri in source number 3. Rashi quotes this on our Pasuk to explain Torim in one of the grosser ways possible. The Plishtim say, woe is us, who is going to save us from this mighty God? Ad kan omru tzadikim. That's what the righteous Plishtim said. The better Plishtim said, who's going to save us from God? Meaning they believed this was God who had done it to them. Alvo Rishoyim Amru, but the wicked said something else in the same Pasuk. They're different. What this is doing, I should explain it better. Go back to Pasuk Chet for a second, sentence 8, inside the text in chapter 5, and you'll see what this Medrash is picking up on. Chapter 5, sentence 8. No, but you should hope. So, in the middle of the sentence, Vayomru, and they said, the Plishtim said, Mana Sela Aron Elokei Yisrael. Sorry, that's not the pasuk that I wanted. Just kidding. Sorry. My mistake. Perek Dalet. Sorry. Perek Dalet Pasuk Chet. Yeah, my mistake. Sorry. It's this is talking about when the Jews first brought the Aron out to war. So, look at the Plishti reaction. Oy lanu, woe is us, miyad silenu miyad ha-elokim ha-adirim ha-ele. Who is going to save us from this mighty God? Yeah, because the word Elohim is inherently plural. They like Naseh Adam. Elohim ha-elokim ha-makim es Mitzrayim b'chol makav ba-midbar. This is the God who struck the Egyptians with every blow in the wilderness. So the Medrash is bothered by the verbosity of this. And says, you know what? Two different things going on in this sentence. Now go back to source number 3. The first half of the sentence, who's going to save us from this mighty God? That is the Plishtim who believe. Right. Rishoyim Amru, but the wicked said, Elohim Halokim Makim es Mitzrayim b'chol makav b'midbar, this is the one who struck the Egyptians. Amru, they said, yeah, Eser Makos Hayulo, he had 10 plagues. And he brought them on the Egyptians. B'chol makah, every plague, right? So he did every plague to them already. Shuvelo makah ameata, he's got nothing left. His bag's empty.
That's his repertoire.
Amar le'amakom, to which God said, Atem omrim she'li makah me'ata. What, you think I don't have anything left? Makah me'avi alechem, shloni yasa me'olam. I'm going to do something to you that's never happened before. There's a very similar passage in the Gemara in Gittin regarding Titus, that when Titus is returning after sacking the temple, and he has all his stuff on the boat, he puts himself in danger by being on a boat. You know, you're on the water, things can happen. And so, at that point, the big wave comes up, and it's going to drown him, and Titus says, this God only has power on the water. Right? He flooded the generation of the flood. He drowned the Egyptians. All he's got is water. And God says, okay, so go on land and fight me there. And I think that's actually going to appear on the source sheet later in source number 9. So we'll see more about it there. But that's what's going on here. You think God's done? I have other options. So what does God send them? So one of them would sit in a tahor, which I'm taking as a latrine. And a rodent would come up from below, pull out his intestines and go, I told you. And go down to the depths. As the pasuk says, God's hand was heavy on the Ashdodim. That's the idea. Where in the world did you get the idea that that's what Tehorim are? So the answer is going to be in chapter 6. Because in chapter 6, they're going to return to the Aron. But when they return to the Aron, they send, you're going to love this, gold statues of rodents.
Rodents, mice, rats.
So why would squirrels, they dignify the rodents?
Black squirrels from Toronto.
Why would they dignify the rodents with gold statues?
Their idea is this is what God used against us, and we are acknowledging that God is right, and we're going to send him statues of gold rats.
Tahor means that, like latrine, you're saying. That's the word.
So that's what it sounds like in context here, although we're going to see a related use of it. But that's the idea. That's one take. What?
Is it like whore, a hole?
No, it's not. The tet has to be part of the root. It gets better. Take a look at source number four. By better, I mean worse.
They taught us.
Yes, they do. Source number four. Anyone who doesn't want to hear this, you've been warned. The Vaktiv Hushem Kinoi Letachtoniyot. The written word is a euphemism for bowels. Ki apule lashon gvohot, because the word ayin pe lamed, which is the way it's written, not the way it's pronounced, means heights. If you remember from Nehemiah, when we did the area, the wall around the city in Nehemiah in chapter 2, chapter 3, so there was an area called the Ophel, ayin vav pe lamed, that was considered a high up area. So it's a euphemism. Apule is the way it's written. But what it actually means is the lowest place. What it means is the latrine or the bowels. That's what Tchorim is referring to. Vakriu Shema Choli. He says the pronounced word, the way you say Tchorim, is actually the name of the illness, meaning, and what Radak says, and I skipped it just to be kind to you, but it's an illness of the bowels that manifests when someone is having trouble using the washroom. That's what this is. So, thank you. Well. that's what I omitted. Correct.
So
it says it in the Arts World. I put it in for you. Okay. So that's Radak. So you have two different explanations. Both of them hinge on the same point, which is trouble for the Plishtim, not just trouble, but pain for the Plishtim, when they try to use the latrine. And so the question you have to ask is, what's the goal? Why this? I mean, I understand that you want to do something you didn't do to Egypt, but I'm pretty sure that there were other things you could have done.
Millions.
So why does Hashem choose this?
Right, each of the makos, we learn, has something specific to teach the ministerium. So what specific did this have to teach?
Well, it's kind of interesting because this is a very natural human function.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we even have brachot, you say, right? Not to personalize it, but my father had a colostomy. And it was, changes your life, mm-hmm. you don't do that function anymore, and it takes away a whole human aspect to your living in a very, base kind of way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, what else can you do? You can, cut off an arm. Okay, you can still have another arm. You know, this is just
this
so...
This is fundamental to what human beings
fundamental,
do.
Thank you. In terms of, natural...
That's the whole thing, is that it's a base kind of punishment. It's very base. It's humiliating.
That's a key word. So let me first go back to suggest the simple approach.
No,
first a simple approach, and then I think a more challenging one. The first and most basic is that it's a punishment because it's a very bad thing to have. Right? It's just, this is a very bad plague. And think about where it shows up. It shows up here, and it shows up for us in the Tochacha. That's where you put really bad punishments. The Tochacha, that section of warning that I mentioned before from Dvarim, where this pasuk appears.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to take it, and Ralbach seems like that. Take a look at source number 5, where he says, "Vizos hamaka haisa shukuba techorim." The plague was they were struck with techorim. V'hu choli mitzair meod. It's really painful. V'yotzei mehem dam rav, and it causes a lot of bleeding. Thank you, Ralbach. The Abarbanel adds an element to it based on a word that's used. The word in pasuk Ted in chapter 5, sentence 9, vayisa. Satru lahem apolim, you see that? Vayisatru, state there. It's in a spot that is hidden in the body, and therefore it's hard to treat. So it's not just that it's painful, and it's not just that it's debilitating and dehumanizing and everything else, but it's also you can't do anything about this. So so on one level, it's just a really bad thing to have. However, I think the humiliation is really important, because these are people who took the Aram and put it with Dagon to say, we beat God.
Okay.
goes back to that exposure.
And so, exactly. And so, you can't even beat this. You can't even beat the rodents or whatever this problem that they have is. Rashi in Yeshaya sees it over there. The pasuk in the beginning of Yeshaya Perek Mem Vav has this very vivid mockery of idolatry. I didn't bring it on your sheet. I really should have. In which it describes, though, Kara Baal Keres Nivo. Kara, Kafrei Shayin, to kneel. Baal is the idol. Baal kneels, and the image is, as the pasuk continues, Lo yucham aleit masa, it cannot rid itself of its burden. The image is of the idol trying to use the washroom and being incapable of doing so. Rashi there comments. Source number 6. Elahusam shel Babel, the idols of Babel, the gods of Babel, Kar'u, Karsu, Lashon Schok, shel avodah kochavim umazal osu. He says this is making fun of the idol. Kemisha yesh l'choli me'ayim, like somebody who has intestinal trouble. Ve'ena maspik le'sheva moshav beis hakisei adshu nitraz, it can't even reach the washroom in time. The Gemara in Megillah, source number 7, says the following. Kol leitza nusa asira. That Gemara is in the middle of a passage. I think it's in the, it appears in a couple of places. The other one for sure, maybe not the one in Megillah, is the part of a passage which talks about how bad it is for people to be cynical and for people to mock and to make fun. That as a general rule, you're not allowed to make fun of things, the Gemara says. It's a bad trait. However, except for one. Kol leitzanusa asira bar mitzil leitzanusa davodah zara, except when you're dealing with idolatry. Desharia, there it is permitted. The rationale for permitting it with idolatry is the whole rest of the world is elevating it and praising it and saying it's wonderful, so you're not neutral with it. You're constantly hearing how good it is. So therefore, you need to bring it down a peg in order that you not be influenced by the positive approach that everybody has to it. That's the idea of being allowed to do it. But how does the Gemara know that that this is allowed? So it continues by saying Dichsev, like the pasuk in Yeshaya chapter 46, Karabel Kerez Nivo Karsuko Yachtav Luyucham Aleit Masa. This whole description there that mocks the idol. If Yeshaya can do it, I guess that means that. That this is okay. That's the idea. It's not just Yeshaya, it's also in the 10th chapter in Hosea. So, based on that, this idea that mocking the idol is allowed, I think that's what's going on for them, because we also find it elsewhere. Take a look at source number 8. This is a story in the Gemara regarding a fellow by the name of Bar Daroma, when the Jews had revolted against the Romans. So, Havabahu Hahu Bar Daroma, Dava Kafitz Mila Vakatil Bahu. The Jews had a warrior. His name was Bar Daroma, fellow from the south. He was so powerful, he would jump a mil. A mil is a kilometer. Yes, I expect that this is an exaggeration. But he could jump really far, the Katil Bahu, and then he could kill somebody where he landed. He could then attack, and he came in by surprise, and nobody even saw him coming. And then he'll jump out. Shakli Kesar Latageva Osvayara. So the Caesar gets the reports in that his troops are being destroyed by this one guy. He takes his crown, he puts it on the ground. Amar, and he says, Ribona de Alma Kule, he says, Master of the Universe. Inechalach, if it's okay with you, Lotimsre Lahu Gavra Lidideul Malchuse Beyade de Chad Gavra, do not hand over that man, meaning myself, and his entire kingdom to just one guy.
Caesar doesn't want God to hand him over?
Caesar says, I don't want my entire kingdom handed over to one guy.
So Caesar accepts God.
In some sense, yes. So, Akshle Pume le Bar Daroma. And sure enough, what happens? Bar Daroma stumbles verbally. V'omar, he said, Halo ata Elohim zinachtanu, v'lo teitze Elohim b'tzivoseinu. God, you've abandoned us. You don't come out with our armies. We have to do this all ourselves. I've seen two different ways to take that line. Either that he's exclaiming God isn't helping us, or that he's actually saying, God, don't help us. Like, don't help us, don't hurt us type of a thing. To which the Gemara then has a parenthetical note and says, well, that's actually a pasuk in Tehillim. David said that. To which the Gemara says, no, David asmoi kamasma. David was expressing surprise. Like, God, don't you go out with our armies anymore? Don't you help us anymore? With Bar Daroma saying, God doesn't, or God shouldn't. So what happened to him? This is the point. Al lebeis hakisei, Bar Daroma goes to the washroom. Asa darkona shamte lekarka shevenach nafshe. Snake comes along, takes out his bowels, and he is done. So it's the same image. It's the same image. It's about the arrogance and them being humbled. And the proof of this is actually... Oh, I also brought you... This is number 9, is that story with Titus. Remember I said to you before that Titus, after sacking the Beis HaMikdash, says that... God can only fight me on the water. So God says, go up on land and do battle with my tiny little creature called a yitush. In Hebrew, a gnat in English. And the gnat, the way this...
Mosquito,
gnat, one or the other. It doesn't make a difference for our purposes. The point is, it's a really tiny creature. And it enters his through his nostrils. It eats its way through membranes, gets into his brain.
That image made me have nightmares as a child.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, seriously. It was just...
I believe you.
It's so powerful, though. But that's, yeah. And that's not a bad thing.
But no, but the idea is of the arrogant person being laid low.
Exactly.
So take a look at source number 10 now, because we've quoted that chapter from Tehillim. Tehillim Ayin Chet, chapter 78 from Psalms. That chapter is the one that talks about the destruction of Shiloh. And look at this pasuk from that section. Vayach Sarav Achor. God struck his enemy Achor, literally behind. Cherpas olam nasan lamo, and gave them eternal shame. That's what the point is. It's shame. It's cherpat olam. That's what God is. This supports the idea that this is about humiliation. Then I saw Barbanel also in the beginning of Perek Vav does this too. And not only that, but now you mentioned how in Egypt there's an idea behind the things that God does. Think about it. In Egypt, God strikes the Nile first, right? Why does God strike the Nile first? Diane just said it. It's their God, right? He strikes the Nile, turning it to blood. Then he causes it to generate frogs, right? Before he gets around to harming the people themselves. God started with Dagon, right? Knocked it over, cut off the hands, cut off the head, and then came after the people. It's the same type of an approach.
You knock down their gods, and then...
And then you attack them. So that's a second element here. Yes?
I think there is also another comparison, because the Pharaoh, his heart hardened. Mm-hmm. And here the Plishtim, instead of learning a lesson, as though they are also, their hearts are hardened.
Good.
They really care what happened to these people. They send them over there. And it's just... Eventually, it gets to them.
Then. Excellent. So Ricky points out something that now we'll jump to another passage just to show it inside. Okay. Chapter 6, sentence 6.
Is that also the sentence
6 before? Well, there it's Hashem's hand hardening, but take a look at the next one. Yeah. This is the advice given by the priests of the Plishtim when the people want to know what they ought to do. So look at what the priests say. Why are you hardening your heart or honoring your heart? We'll have to come back to that. The way the Paro and the Egyptians did it with their heart. So exactly the association. There's more to be said about that pasuk when we get there. But okay. So what we've seen so far is that in this plague of Apolim / Techorim, okay, and now we have a little bit of a sense of what's going on when we write it one way, read it another. The word apolim is a euphemism. It means the heights. It's written as a euphemism, so the text itself doesn't want to say techorim. But when you read it, you need to know what you're talking about. So therefore, you say the word that's really meant, which is techorim. That's the idea in the text here. But in terms of
makes a lot of sense. We say, "Oh, you look great today." I mean the opposite.
I would not do that, but yes. That's with an aleph. Yeah. In terms of what the lessons are here, so first of all, it's defeat of Dagon, right? Cutting off the hands and the head. Second is humiliation. Right, this humiliation of the Plishtim who had been so arrogant, especially if you take the view that that's why they put the Aron there. And then the third element of it, this is fascinating to me. I haven't seen anyone note this, but I think it's very clear that that's what's going on. This also goes back to our first encounter with the Plishtim. When's the first time we encounter Plishtim in the Torah? Before that.
What?
Yep.
Abraham?
Abraham and Sarah.
Oh, yeah.
No. Right? Abraham and Sarah go to Gerar. This is after Sodom is destroyed. They move out of the area. They go down to Gerar, the land of the Plishtim. And Abraham and Sarah do the same thing all over again. Sarah is my sister. And Abimelech takes Sarah. And Hashem comes to him and says, that's a really bad idea. Right? And then he gives her back. Right? Remember that story? It's in Bereishit Perek Chaf. So take a look at source number 11. Those are Plishtim. Now, technically, biologically, they may not be Plishtim, meaning there are different populations that come through that area at different times, but they reside in the area called Peleshet, and they are viewed as the ancestors of the later
Where
Plishtim.
Where is that story? That's near
in Gaza.
No. So it is in the south. I always thought it was there, but then there was some reference to it being near.
No, this is south and west.
Gaza, yeah.
Yeah, by the Mediterranean. So look at that pasuk. This is the end of that story after Sarah has been returned. And Hashem says to him, you know, if you give back Sarah, maybe Abram will daven for you. Vayispalel Abraham el ha'elokim. Abram prayed to God. Vayirpa elokim es Avimelech ves ishto ve'am hosav vayeledu. And Hashem healed Abraham, healed Avimelech, healed his wife, healed his maids, and they gave birth. Why did they suddenly give birth? Ki atzor atzar Hashem be'ad kol rechem leveis Avimelech al devar Sarah eshes Abraham. Because when Sarah was taken, Hashem sealed up all of the wombs in the household of Sarah. Well, we're not done with that. Take a look at source number 12. I chose not to translate all of source number 12 because it's just too gross. I'm sorry. I couldn't bring myself to do it. But you're going to read it and you'll see. You'll see exactly what it's talking about. Right. Well, Latsor is to stop.
It's also Asherut is constipation.
Right. Take a look. Hello.
Latsor.
Source number 12. But Gemara Baba Kama, ki atzor atzar Hashem. So the Gemara picks up on the verbs, the double verb, right? Atzor atzar, not just atzar Hashem, but atzor atzar. What does that mean? Usually, having a double force means something. A double verb means that it's more forceful. But here, I don't understand. What would that mean? So he says, no, it's not about it being more forceful. It's about it being multiple things. Shtei atziros halalulama. Why have two verbs? Achas be'ish shechva zera, shtayim be'ish shechva zera v'leida. The answer is God prevented not only birth but also conception. So two different things. And then it gives you a brisa which says actually no, it was that plus it was also, and it goes on to discuss the other uses, use of the washroom and so on, all being halted at this point. I think the basis for it is not only atzor atzar, the double verb, which is not about force here, but has to be about something. But I think there's more evidence to it. I think that there's something else here. First of all, the fact that it says it affected everybody in the household. How many of them were slated to give birth that one day? Was it just like that was C-section day and they were all waiting? Like it doesn't make any sense that it would have affected the way it's described in the pasuk. Kol rechem beis avimelech. It sounds like it's much more than that. I think that's one way. And then there's something else. Go back to the pasuk in source number 11 and you tell me, how else do you know it's not just about giving birth?
No,
there you go. Right, because Avimelech, as far as I can tell, never gave birth in his life. So the answer must be that it's broader than just the ability to give birth.
No, it says he's talking about the sense by your
power. Yeah. So what I'm getting at here by showing you this is, number one, we're going to see at least three connections between this story and that story with Sarah and the Plishtim before we're done.
What is the time period between Sarah getting pregnant with Yitzchak and when she was taken?
So I'll come back to that. It remind me of that question in a minute. I just want to do this first. Okay? I'll come back to that. I just want to finish this thought first, or I'm going to lose my train on it. What you're seeing here is, number one, it's meant to bring to mind in general, that past experience with the Plishtim, but I think it's also a message that's being given to the Plishtim. Separate from the initial message about their God, and separate from the humiliation, it's a message, you should have known better, because this has happened before. Way back when Abraham showed up, you know, I did this, and you should have learned from there not to start up with me. But you didn't. And so I'm going to bring back the same thing that I did, David Melech and Co. I'm going to do again. Because you didn't learn the lesson the first time.
How are they supposed to remember?
They're national memories of certain things. I mean, yes, you're talking about a very, very long period of time, without a doubt. But that's the idea, I think, is that it's meant to say, you know, you guys didn't pick up on what I tried to teach you way back when. But I wanted to go back to the next question just briefly. The Midrashim talk about the party that they made after Yitzchak was born, and it's very interesting to see. It describes how Sarah is nursing children at the party and so on. What the Midrash is building on is that there were those who challenged Abraham's paternity of Yitzchak, because they said it was really Avimelech. So having Sarah nurse isn't what demonstrates that it's actually her child. It's her child regardless. But also that Yitzchak looks exactly like Avraham is meant to do that. And as a matter of fact, the Netziv wrote that that's why Yishmael got kicked out of the house.
That's why, sorry?
Why Yishmael got kicked out. Meaning that we're told at that party that Sarah sees Yishmael mitzachik. Now, the Medrash is bothered, what does Mitzachek mean? What is he doing with Mitzachek? And it shows you that the word Mitzachek can mean different things in Chumash and in Navi. However, the Netziv says, what he's doing is he's declaring Yitzchak isn't really the heir of Abraham. Yitzchak's not legitimate. He's making fun of the idea that Yitzchak is there, and that's why what Sarah says is, my son is not going to inherit with him. Meaning, he's not legit. My son is the one who is legitimate, and therefore, get him out of the house. And that's because he is challenging the legitimacy. So there were those who challenged it, because in fact the stories are presented side by side. This story is in chapter 20, and then Sarah becoming pregnant is in chapter 21.
Is she saying that if her child that gives it legitimate, it doesn't matter who the father is?
No, it's saying that my child is Abraham's true heir.
He's the
one for whom God says he's fucking. Yeah.
Probably they were married for so long and they had no children. All of a sudden she gets kidnapped by her and suddenly
she's
pregnant.
Right. To which Rashi.
She's Abraham's for him.
I thought Abimelech wasn't to blame for this. Like, Abraham said she was.
Yeah, he was bad, Abraham.
No, because hang on. Go back like three steps. First of all, yes, the idea that Rashi mentions there, which is an idea found in the Gemara and Brachos as well, is that when you daven for somebody else, you'll be answered. And even you'll be answered first. So Abraham davens for the womb to be opened in the house of Avimelech, and therefore Sarah is able now to have a child. That's how they point that out regarding the timing there. But what Abraham and Sarah do is a reaction. It's a reaction to a fear that if you don't do it, Sarah's going to be taken anyway and Abraham's going to get killed. That's what the people always get confused about this. Is Abraham asking Sarah to take a hit for him? No. Sarah is going to be taken either way. By going there, they know that once people start asking them questions, Sarah's gone. The only question is Abraham going to survive or not? And so he feels better that I should at least survive and can do something, as opposed to Sarah is taken and I'm a dead man. That's the rationale behind it.
So if he's the brother, they won't kill him. If he's the husband,
right. Correct. Right. Correct. Right. Because they have a taboo against taking a married woman. So just kill the husband.
The answer is to kill the husband.
Right. Murder is not a taboo.
That's not a problem.
That's the idea. Okay. So what we're seeing here... Sorry?
No.
What we're seeing here then is this. Again, you have different ways to look at what they did with the Aron, but the dominant approach here is that the point is to demonstrate to the Plishtim divine superiority over Avodah Zarah. And to do so, God demonstrates the Dagon's weakness, humiliates the people, and reminds them, you know, we've done this before.
But this is also a warning to others. It is a strong warning to us not to take the Aron.
Yes, it's a good idea to leave the Aron alone. Yeah.
Yep.
One other note, though, on what Hashem does to Dagon. We've seen...
Well, we didn't answer the question.
How long? No, so the answer is we don't know, but the two stories are presented side by side in the Chumash. We don't have dates on it. Yeah. So, you know, in the same way that the idea that the Akedah is right before Sarah dies, right? That's also just because they're juxtaposed in the Chumash. We don't actually know. We're not given a date. Okay. But one other note on this business with Dagon. We've suggested that what Hashem does to Dagon is a level of punishment, is a level of education and correction. But I think there's another piece to this. And I think it's an important one. Because it's going to feed into where we're going in the next parak as well. Watch how the Plishtim react. What was the reaction of the Plishtim when Dagon had, first when it fell over, and then when the head and the hands were cut off?
They put it right back.
That's exactly right. Go back to the beginning of chapter 5 and look at sentence 3. The first thing that they did, they came in the morning, right? Early in the morning, mind you. And Dagon has fallen on the ground, so what do? They put him back in his place. Then in sentence 4, they get up again the next morning, and they find that the head and the hands are cut off, and they're on the threshold. And what do? We are not going to walk on this threshold anymore. And at the time, we asked, why is Tanakh interested in recording the history of who steps on a threshold in the house of Dagon? Like, why does this matter? Why is Shmuel interested in recording this? So it could just be historical artifact. Hey, isn't that cool? And maybe it demonstrates, look, this really happened. They still have a practice to this day. But I'm going to give you a different answer based on a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Take a look at source 13, please. The Gemara is talking about something that we've discussed a little bit on other occasions, which is Bitul Avodah Zarah. An idol remains an idol, even if there is no one around who worships it. If I go to some ancient archaeological site and they dug up an idol, it's still an idol. I'm not allowed to benefit from it, for example. However, if someone who had worshipped it rejects it, says, I'm not serving this thing anymore, that's called bitul. It's canceling the status of the Avodah Zarah, canceling the status of the idol. So the Gemara asks a question. Can you assume that at a certain point an idol has been abandoned? You know, for example, you go into some area where, let's say there had been a war, and the population fled. Right? The population is now gone. And they left behind various statues and whatever. Can you assume that they rejected those idols now? Because look, they fled and they left them behind. Or not? Is it just that they were in a rush and they were saving their lives and they left them, but maybe they would come back and worship them if they had the opportunity? And so on in other circumstances. So take a look at source number 13. Itmar, it was taught. Avodas kochavim shenishtabra me'eleha. If an idol breaks on its own, no one came in and smashed it, but just one day the idol is broken on the floor, like what happened in our story. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Asura. Rabbi Yochanan says, doesn't matter, it's still prohibited. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, also known as Reish Lakish, Amar Mutares. Reish Lakish says, no, the idol's fine. Not fine, sorry. It is permitted, meaning that it's not an idol anymore. We assume it has been abandoned. What's the rationale for each view? Rabbi Yochanan Amar Asura Dahalo Bitla. Rabbi Yochanan says, it's Asur, it's prohibited, because no one has actually canceled it. No one has done a formal rejection of it. It's just broke. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Amar Mutares. Reish Lakish says, no, it is permitted. Why? Mistama betule mevatila. Because you can assume that when they come in and they find the idol broken, they're not going to worship it anymore. Meimer Amar, they're going to say to themselves, Ihi nasha lo atzla. It couldn't save itself. Lahu gavra mazlale. It's going to save me? It can't do anything for me. Obviously, it broke. So what they're doing is the psychology of idolatry. How much power is invested in the idol as far as they are concerned? And the first view here, the view of Rabbi Yochanan is, they don't stop worshiping their god just because something happens to the idol. They don't necessarily think that that means the god is that their god is powerless. And Rabbi Yochanan disagrees. I mean, Rish Lakish disagrees. So, Esa, Rabbi Yochanan, and the Rish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan challenges Rish Lakish, and he says, "Really? You think that they abandoned it? Look at our story." Right? The head of Dagon and the two hands are cut off, and they still said it's holy. They wouldn't step on the threshold where the head and the hands landed. That shows that they do still worship it. Omar lo, to which the response comes from Reish Lakish, Misham Raya, that's your proof. They're not worshiping Dagon anymore. Now, they're worshiping the threshold where it landed. They're saying the strength has left Dagon and it now resides in the... Now we've got down to the threshold. That's the way he reads the Pesukim. But my point, and the reason why I mention it here, the reason why I bring this is that you could understand this as mocking them. Like, look at that, the head and the hands of the idol were cut off and still they're worshiping. But I look at it as Musar for the Jews. It's rebuke to the Jews, meaning, look how loyal they are to their Avodah Zarah.
Yeah.
You know, the head and the hands were cut off on the floor, and they continue to worship it, right? And you guys had an Aron in Shiloh. First, nobody visited. Then Chofni and Pinchas abused it. You know, you turned it into a device for your own enrichment. And that's going to feed into the opening sentence in the next chapter. Just very quickly, read the opening sentence of chapter 6. We're going to come back to it, God willing, after the break. But take a look. Vayhi Aron Hashem b'steif lishtim shiv'a chadashim. The Aron is in the field of the plishtim for 7 months, and then the story goes on. No explanation of why 7 months matters at all. But if you ask me, the 7 months is a rebuke. We're going to see it supported in a medrash next time, God willing. It's a rebuke to them. 7 months, the Aron was among the plishtim, and you didn't come after it.
But you know? Didn't want to get rid of it either, wasn't it causing all that harm?
Well, the plishtim.
No.
Yeah.
That's the plishtim, but it's about the Jews.
The Jews didn't go to retrieve it.
They want to get rid of it because it was...
The plishtim, so they spent 7 months with it circulating in different cities.
Torturing...
Yeah.
But I think the message
that's being offered to the Jews here is that's being offered to the reader is, you know, they don't stop. They're loyal to their God. You know, not unlike what you sometimes hear when somebody from another religion comes into a shul and they observe what goes on in shul and say, you know, we would never act that way. And we always have ways to defend our practices, and people will respond what they respond. But fundamentally, what's being said here is, look at the plishtim. They have something to teach you. Their respect persists even when they have reason to stop. You know, how much more so you should be treating God and the Aron and the Mishkan with greater honor. So that wraps chapter 5, God willing, in a couple of weeks. Well,
start, it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks?
It's actually 3. We're missing 2 weeks. We're missing the 27th. We're missing the 3rd.
Right.
January 10th. Oh, you're back January 10th?
Yeah.
Okay, so January 10th we will continue. Please remember, I'll send out an email again with the Heroes and Villains program on Tuesday. I hope you'll be able to make it. Thank